I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And this, at this time, John and Dick start the technical man. John is KC2 WGB, and I'm Richard Dick K2R IW. As you guys have heard so many times, the major purpose of the technical net is education about wireless technology in general, ham radio, and so on. Probably tonight a good deal of the discussion is going to be on the subject of generators, because quite a few people have sent me telephone messages. I don't have any email, so you can't email me. So people have sent me telephone messages telling me that they want to discuss generators, size, how to hook them up, dangers, gasoline, fuel, should they be running on liquid propane, natural gas, gasoline, or fuel oil, number two fuel oil, diesel fuel, so to speak. Lots of discussions on that. You probably know that something in the vicinity of five or more people have died during this event because of misuse of a generator, usually carbon monoxide poisoning. A huge number of people have died in Staten Island because of drowning, among other things, something in the vicinity of 120 people. So there's a lot of misery here. This particular, let me drop. We have just been through an event that is a more than a once per 50 year event. I live in a so-called 75 mile an hour wind area, according to all the good charts on that particular subject. And I think the weather reports did say that Islip, which is the next town south of me, experienced 90 mile an hour winds, and I suspect that I had a gust that was considerably above that. Obvious, by the way, a number of my 85 foot high trees got snapped at the top or broken over at the bottom, and my neighborhood was reasonably devastated. I could only drive, I could walk one night, I guess about an eighth of a mile, and see about five or six trees in that eighth of a mile that are laying across the road and laying across power lines and so on. So this was probably a once per 50 or once per 100 year event, the combination of Hurricane Sandy plus the nor'easter. So generators are suddenly becoming a lot more the subject, very similar to what happened after Hurricane Gloria. After Hurricane Gloria, I worked for Airborne Instruments Laboratory. A number of people were without power for a week or two at a time, living a miserable lifestyle, and they said, never again is it going to happen to me. I want that company to find a generator I can buy. And I was part of a team that found a particular generator that we settled on, which worked on all three fuels, liquid propane, natural gas, gasoline, had a self-starter, an electric starter in it, and 4 kilowatts. And in my opinion, it was more than the requirement for most of those people. You'll talk to people who go out and buy a generator of 10 kilowatts and even bigger numbers, and for occasional use, I don't think it's required, but that's a bunch of opinions. So 500 and some odd of those generators were purchased for airborne employees. It was an extremely large purchase from a Midwestern company, Earth Energy Systems. The Winco generator is what we bought, 4,000 watts. And we put a few percent of the Shoreham nuclear station capability into people's backyards, if you know what I mean. So right after Gloria, which was 1985, I think it was September, let me drop it. Right after Hurricane Gloria, tremendous numbers of people wanted generators. So Airborne Instruments Laboratory was one company that purchased about 550, I think it was. The Brookhaven Laboratory people headed up by Andy Feldman, WB2FXN. I think they purchased something close to 1,000 generators. They chose a different model number from us. I'm having trouble remembering the number of the one that they chose. His philosophy of life, Andy, W2CDL, his philosophy was to find the generator that gave the lowest possible price but still produced 4,000 watts. So he chose a fairly bare-bones machine, whereas we chose a machine that was probably $30 or $40 more expensive per generator. And when you're spending $525 per generator, that last little bit, to me, sometimes is worth it. My wife will sometimes select the Best Buy when it's a piece of furniture or an automobile or whatever, And after she's made her selection, I ask her the question, if we spent 10% more in dollars, do we get 50% more in capability or in performance or in longevity or in reliability and so on? So the absolute bottom line to me is not necessarily the way of getting the least cost of ownership. That's one way of looking at the total picture when you buy something like that. So we chose one a little bit more expensive. The employees at the time were not that shy on cash. They were slightly affluent by engineering standards, and then for a little bit of extra dollars, gave us an electric start. It produced it was built by a Canadian standard. I can't remember the standard right now. Let me drop it. And to that Canadian standard, it had a pair of 110-volt outputs, a 220-volt output, a built-in circuit breaker, electric start, 12-volt output. In other words, its output would charge the battery that was used for the electric start. It had a low oil indicator, which if the oil in the crankcase ran low, the generator would automatically turn itself off. And I'm hearing a fair number of stories of people who run out to the generator every couple of hours, put gasoline in it, and never check whether or not the oil is running low. And that can be very destructive. So it had an oil level indicator, ran on triple fuel, industrial commercial rated engine, steel sleeve engine. We thought we were buying a quasi Cadillac. Of all the things that were nice and not so nice about the generator, the only thing that was less than ideal is that the tank was not big enough. You had to refill it every couple of hours when you're using it under heavy load. It was 156 pounds, so moving it around was not super easy. It didn't come with wheels. And the muffler was not as quiet as I would have liked. But those are things that you can easily modify yourself. You can put wheels on it, and some people did. You can put a better muffler on it, and some people did. You can put a bigger fuel tank on it, and some people did. So we thought, but by the standards at that time, we thought we were giving a lot of performance, and essentially for the dollar, and essentially none of the employees who purchased it had any real complaints. In the process of delivering those 550 generators to the employees, which was a great big warehouse we rented in order to do that, the process of passing them out got kind of complicated. Some people didn't want to pick it up. They wanted it delivered and things along those lines. But what I was doing, the process of passing out the generators went for about a month and a half, as I remember. So every week I was publishing a report.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Every week I was publishing a report that I called the Generator News. And some of the main things that I had to indicate to people is that something like 5% of the employees had a strong indication that they were going to mount the generator in their basement and create some kind of an exhaust system going outdoors. Absolutely, positively not the recommended thing to do. Tremendous number of reasons why you would not put that machine in a basement or in a garage. It's got to be operated outdoors, let me pick a number, at least 20 feet away from the house. And hopefully the wind is blowing in the right direction so the fumes coming out of the engine don't blow into an open window at the house, if you know what I mean, and come back into the house. You don't want the noise, you don't want the fuel, and you don't want the exhaust anywhere near your house. That is an outdoor machine. And yes, you don't leave it out there continuously. You have to take it back in after you finish using it, or put it into a shed that hopefully has low humidity so you don't run into rusting problems and things like that. So it took a whole lot of individual things to be considered in order to properly use a generator, properly feed it, and then how do you actually take the electrical output and how do you use it in the house. As you can tell, there's a whole lot of things to be discussed. But I had tremendous difficulty convincing people, absolutely, you check with your codes, you check with your electrical experts, you check with your experts of any kind. They will all tell you to a man, do not put that anywhere near the house. Don't put it in the house. Don't put it in the garage. So these are some of those five people who died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Obviously, they did something wrong along those lines. So these are, give you a little bit of hint of what I think is one of the subjects we should be discussing tonight because of what we've all been through and are still going through. A person signs into the technical net because you're going to give John and Dick your call letters, your name, And the word yes, which means
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because you do believe you're going to have a question or a comment for the net, so you're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes. So, do we have any check-ins tonight for TechNet number 4,124 of the series that began in September of 1982? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
V2RIY, Joe, yes.
Okay, so far I've heard Joe and Wes. There was someone else with very low audio attempting to check in. So, besides Joe and Wes, who else was trying to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2AMZ, KD2AMZ, Mike, and yes.
And WS2N, Paul.
No traffic, Dick. I'm going to listen to generator stories.
K2ADB, and yes, I have a question.
Okay, that time we picked up Mike, KD2 Alpha Mike Zulu. We picked up Paul, WS2N. We picked up K2 Alpha Delta Bravo, it sounds like. Alpha Delta Bravo. Correct me on Alpha Delta Bravo and please tell me your name. K2ADB, K2LAW.
Kilo 2, Alpha Delta Victor, it's JD Dick. Good evening.
I'm pretty sure you gave me your name, Alpha Delta Victor. And tell me your name once more. Did you say Jamie?
JD Juliet Delta. Am I having a problem getting out? My audio bad? Need some adjustment here?
No, it's perfect, JD. It's me. I was tuned. My ears were tuned to hear a proper name, not a set of abbreviations. Alrighty. So we've got Joe, Mike, JD, Paul, Wes. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW listening.
The name is Kim, and I'll just be listening.
Okay, we heard Kim. Did I also hear Jim? KC2, why can't I think of Jim's call letters now? I'm terrible.
What?
What were those callers again, Paul? I'm emptying the brain tonight. Go ahead, Ben. I mean, John, what was Jim's call letters?
B-H-Y, Dick.
KD2BHY. Yeah. And I'm not sure whether or not Jim has signed in. All right, one last call. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LAW.
Hey, Chris. No question.
Okay, we have more than enough to get started. Let's start off with Joe. WA2RYY. Joe, how are things for you? In other words, how many days were you out of power? You own a generator, and you have suggestions along those lines. Or your other question you might want to discuss. W2LYY, K2LAW.
I was not without power. It blinked on and off occasionally. I didn't lose power really for any length of time. I don't own a generator, and someday I probably will. And my question is not concerning generators.
That's okay, Joe. Go right ahead with your question, and then we'll get into generators, quite possibly. You got it, Joe.
Okay, we're good, Dick. This question goes back to something I asked a couple of weeks ago about amplifying several carriers at once, or many carriers at once, in an AM type of amplifying system. But let me just ask the question, and maybe you can come figure it out backwards if I get the answer that I'm looking for. You said that a peak reading type of meter would be necessary to determine if a level exceeding a certain preset number that you desire would be obtained or not. If you don't have that type of meter that can read a peak type of reading at one point, and you have a spectrum analyzer that's capable of looking at these carriers coming in, that are coming from an amplifying system that's going to drive one major type of amplifier, how would you figure out backwards of what each level of each carrier is supposed to be? An average carrier that you see on a spectrum analyzer, which has, I guess, the ability, I guess they have the ability of like tracehold or something like that to be able to store the carriers and display them later on as far as their peak reading. Figuring out backwards, if you had a number of, say, 15 to 17 carriers that you want to amplify, but you want the combined power not to be above 0 dBm, what would be the way you calculate it backwards to know, to have to know what each carrier would have to be, obviously at a much lower level, that you wouldn't exceed that zero target value? Back to you.
Yeah, you're into a reasonably complicated area. I'm going to try to give you the raw ingredients on this one, Joe. And yes, you could assume that by the way I gave you the information last time we discussed the subject, that I was indicating that a peak envelope power meter would be required. However, the peak envelope power meters that you and I can buy most likely do not have the response that's fast enough for what I'm about to tell you. I know, at least I believe that the actual system you're talking about has a number of individual television signals. Each
radio signals.
Okay, let's step by. Each of those radio signals have an individual channel to them. In other words, there's an individual receiver with an individual automatic gain control. So therefore, if I understand correctly, each of the 15 or so individual carriers, radio signals, are somewhat controlled within a small range of their amplitude. Am I correct on that one so far, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, you are.
Okay, that gives you the ability. Since you have the ability to control each one, and if you came to the conclusion, I'm going to give you the raw ingredients as to how to come to that conclusion, if you came to the conclusion that you want each individual carrier to be at a level of minus 10 dBm, and there's 15 of them, you can then make a very good prediction of what I'm about to tell you. The amplifier itself, let's assume that the amplifier is some number of megahertz wide, where the instantaneous bandwidth of the amplifier is broad enough to cover the individual frequencies of all of the 15 carriers simultaneously. Out of curiosity, Joe, roughly how many megacycles wide is the carrier, is the amplifier that you're talking about?
It's meant to cover standard broadcast band in this country, 1710 kilohertz. It has at least that kind of band. But it actually, by measurement, has a little bit of tilt on it. But you see, what I'm getting at is, if you had two carriers being added together to give you 0 dBm, I believe each carrier with peak value would have to be something like minus 3 dBm by themselves. All right, you follow what I'm saying? So figuring out backwards on that type of scheme, as you put more and more carriers out there, each one is successfully going to be lower and lower in amplitude because the combined value is not to be above 0 dBm. So you follow what I'm talking about? So my question gets in, how do you figure out each carrier if you have a number of, say, up to 15 to 17 carriers?
Yeah, right there, we've already got a problem, Joe. You've used good common sense. Two carriers, you want the average power to be 0 dBm. Therefore, you would set each one at minus 3, and then you would have the right average power. That's one way of looking at it. However, by the time you're adding 15 carriers together, that amplifier, which is around 1.2 megacycles wide, roughly 530 kc to 1700 and something kc, let's call it 1.2 megacycles wide. To you, looking on a spectrum analyzer, you look at the individual carriers on the individual frequencies. The amplifier doesn't look at it that way. The amplifier, in its 1.2 megs of instantaneous bandwidth, all it knows is there is a composite instantaneous voltage that it is amplifying. You and I separate those with something like a spectrum analyzer and individual filters and whatever. It doesn't know that. It's just looking at the whole 1.2 megs, go stripping it all down and looking at the instantaneous voltage waveform. And let me explain what that means. If I wanted to make sure that the instantaneous peak amplitude of the voltage was equivalent to 0 dBm, because Mother Nature, whenever there are multiple signals on different frequencies, Mother Nature, and even if they're on the same frequency, whenever there are individual frequencies being present into a system, you and I live in the dBm world, in the milliwatt world, in the power world. Mother Nature lives in the voltage world. You add the individual voltages. If I've got two individual signals at 0 dBm, for instance, and each one in my particular system happens to be a 1-volt signal, and I combine the two with some kind of an ideal combining device, and I want each output of each individual signal one at a time to be 1 volt, and I put the two together, that instantaneous peak output voltage is 2 volts. 2 volts, because power is a function of voltage squared divided by resistance, is really 6 dB higher. If I wanted to make sure I didn't exceed peak envelope power of an amplifier, and I wanted the peak power to be 0 dBm, each individual carrier, when I'm combining two, would have to be set at minus 6 dBm. A pair of minus sixes will have an average power of minus 3, but a peak envelope power of 0. You see what's going on here? So, to work it backwards, you add up all of the individual voltages, and that gives you the instantaneous peak voltage. That's one way of looking at it. Now, there's one more step going to on this stuff. Let me show you. Now, if I was combining two signals that just happened to be on the extremes of your band, one of them is at 530 kilohertz and the other one is at 1750 kilohertz. They're roughly 1.2 megacycles apart. Now, yes, those two voltages do add in a voltage manner. If each one of them was 1 volt, you will be getting 2 volts peak envelope power. But because the separation is so large, the instantaneous peak is an extremely brief event, way below a microsecond. So now, yes, you're going to be exceeding the amplifier if you run at stronger than minus 6 dBm out of each signal. Maybe you could run each one of them at minus 3 dBm, because the event itself of exceeding peak envelope power is so brief that the amount of distortion it creates, the amount of sidebands, maybe is a tolerable level. So you've now got at least two different ways of looking at this. You can add up all of the powers and divide by the number of signals and set each one at that power level. That would be very non-optimistic. What's the word I'm looking for? That would be non-conservative. You would be overloading the daylights out of the amplifier. You can add up all of the individual voltages and back them off at the right amount so that now the peak envelope power of every one of those carriers in a voltage manner doesn't exceed the 0 dBm of your amplifier. That would be an extremely conservative approach. However, the chances of 15 individual carriers all being at their individual frequencies and their individual phases, just all hitting 0 degrees of phase simultaneously, that's a very rare event. Therefore, you can push your luck a little bit. It's very similar to, let me drop. If the Rovantini company and the Nadel company were designing a telephone system, and you try to design it in such a way that everybody in your district can make a phone call simultaneously, you can see what's happening here. You would have an amount of research, an amount of material, an amount of resources dedicated to that, which would make it extremely expensive. Except for a 9/11 event, you don't have everybody making a phone call simultaneously. So you back off there. The so-called Erlang technique, the telephone people call it, where maybe on the worst case day, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, whatever, maybe you only have 20% of the population at any one instant time trying to make a phone call simultaneously. So you design your system for the 20% point. And so on that rare event like a 9/11, you suffer with the fact that a hell of a lot of people are going to be getting a busy signal and can't get the phone call through. In the case of your particular amplifier, the super conservative approach is add up all the voltages and back off by the, in your particular case, you'd have to back off every one of them to 1/15th of the voltage in order to have the peak envelope power of all of them hitting a 0 degree phase simultaneously, not to exceed the amplifier. But the chances of that happening is so low in probability, you don't have to go that far. But if you back them off by the power, it's not enough. So A power analysis is not enough. A voltage analysis is too much. The right answer is somewhere in between. That's going to require some experimentation for your particular system on a good spectrum analyzer to find out what is the amount of intermodulation distortion you're getting, and is it tolerable by, let's call it, the FCC standards. I haven't given you a nice, clean answer. I know that, Joe. But at least I've told you something about where the minefield is. I've given you some of the information by which you know how to now ask more questions and do more tests for your particular system. W2LYY, T2LAW in the TechNet.
Well, see, Dick, I was looking for more of an answer of what you'd have to do to reduce each carrier as you see it on a spectrum analysis. Because I'll tell you why. Some of the individuals that go out in the field pretty much only know how to use a bird wattmeter, and that's about the extent of their ability. They don't go too much further than that. So you can see which way I'm going with this. You need somebody, obviously, that knows how to use a spectrum analyzer properly to make the proper measurements fairly precisely, that you don't overdrive the amplifier. So I'm trying to come up with an answer because a peak envelope reading power meter is not available. It's just not available. What is available is a spectrum analyzer that's capable of looking at the whole band all at once. So knowing what you have that tool to use, is there any way of approximating an answer of what each carrier would have to be with a range of, say, 15 to 17 carriers? Back to you.
Before I answer that one question, Joe, these amplifiers you're setting up, is it a 1Z2Z, or are you going to be setting up 20 of them across the particular county, so to speak? How many are you going to be installing, Joe? You'll see where I'm going with that in a minute. Go ahead.
I don't know the exact number, but I just can tell you that they're used at different locations for similar purposes, okay? I do know that some of the ones I directly work on, can amplify fairly linearly. If you put, say, 0 dBm in with a single carrier with no modulation, you can get 100 watts out. You can get it settable so you get 100 watts. You increase the drive by 3 dB, you'll get 200 watts. Increase it by 4 dB, you'll get 250 watts, indicated on a bird wattmeter.
Do you know where the 1 dB compression point is on the amplifier? Has that been given to you, Joe? Or have they given it to you the other way around, that during a two-tone test, the third order intermods will be 30 dB down, for instance, when the two signals are at 0 dBm? So when it comes to limiting characteristics of the amplifier, has the manufacturer defined that for you? Over to you, Joe.
Probably so, but I do not remember that exact figure right now.
Yeah, there's usually two different ways that they define that. They tell you the power output of 1 dB compression, or during a two-tone or a three-tone test. Two-tone test, they'll tell you a pair of two-tones at this power level will have intermods at, say, 30 dB down or 40 dB down. That's the usual way. Very rarely will they give you a test with three carriers and tell you what the intermodulation instruction is. So once you know the limiting characteristics of the amplifier, you know something about where the ceiling is, the level that you try not to exceed, because as the amplifier gets shoved into nonlinearity, the 1 dB compression point, for instance, and multiple carriers get you there real fast, then you are using what you think is an amplifier, but it really is a mixer. It will be taking all the possible harmonics of each one of the signals and combining them together in all possible combinations. That's what an amplifier in limiting will do. And now you're about to say, well, I'm not going to go to the limiting level. You've got to be careful here now. The word limiting level is something that you and I can measure. I can, with good instrumentation, I can find for you the 1 dB compression point. I can find for you the 2 dB compression point, the 3 dB compression point, the 0.1 dB compression point, the 0.001 dB compression point. Each one of those compression points has a different level of intermodulation distortion it will create. We usually round things off for simplicity and say, tell me what is the 1 dB compression point. But there's really a little more to the story than that. Let me drop. So in your particular case, 15 to 17 carriers, I do recommend you do this, Joe. On the very first one you set up, hopefully it is characteristic of all the others. the right number of 15 to 17 carriers, and you've got the amplitude adjustment capability of each of the individual carriers, and assuming they all have equal importance, you're setting them all at the same level. And then, by way of a series of tests of adjusting that amplitude and looking for the intermods, when you know exactly where they're going to be, you can find out with your spectrum analyzer during your particular test, the thorough test of the first delivered product. You'll then find out what does a bird watt meter read, and then you tell the guys out in the field, set the bird watt meter that way. That's one possible approach. And assuming now that you've got enough control that the other installations will have close to the same number of carriers, 15 to 17, and you got close to the same amount of control of those carriers, where you can set each of those individual levels, hopefully very close to the same amplitude of each one of them, that way you can get moderately good confidence that the watt meter will do it once you've done a thorough test of the first delivered product. That's probably your best approach, Joe, because mathematically this is a tough one. Adding up all the voltages will give you an answer that's too conservative because it's protecting you from an extremely rare event of when they all happen to line up. That's only going to happen once every 5 seconds for a microsecond of time, if you know what I mean. Or the other approach is if you add up all of the powers and divide and subtract that amount of power, that would be nowhere near conservative enough because Mother Nature is not adding powers, she's adding voltages. Your answer is going to be somewhere between those two extremes, voltage adding or power adding. By way of you doing a thorough spectrum analyzer test of the first delivered article, you'll then find out, once it's set up correctly, how does the watt meter read. WA2RYY, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. See, unfortunately, I can't go back to the manufacturer of this particular device and ask them because they don't exist anymore. And it's impossible to get information from those type of people who originally built it, designed it, and the whatever. That they just don't exist. That's why I'm kind of asking the question here. Because in simplicity, you're talking about intermod and other various things, but in simplicity is, these things are very easy to blow up, okay? Because what they have is internally is four modules within that are combining the power output to give you 100 watts on the output jack of this device. And it has an internal coupler that couples four modules into one. The loss across that coupler is at least 6 dB. So that tells me each module producing about 400 watts of power, each one, to give you 100 watts combined power out of the output of the antenna jack. Thusly, it is easy to blow up these modules if you overdrive them.
You've got reason to believe that the amplifier is good for something in the vicinity of 100 watts output conservatively. You've also, and the manufacturer no longer exists, so you can't find out where is the 1 dB compression point. You don't have to have that. Having the 1 dB compression point by the manufacturer, if he told you the truth, tells you where the ballpark is, and it means that there's a slightly smaller number of steps required to properly set this thing up. But still, you're going to be making the measurements in any case, whether you got the data from the manufacturer or not. So what you do with your first article on that spectrum analyzer is what really counts. By the way, if I want 100 watts of output from an amplifier, and I'm doing hybrid combining, each individual amplifier, if I have ideal 4-to-1 power dividing and combining hybrid device, it does not lose the 6 dB. If I had four modules of 25 watts each going into a 4-to-1 combiner, and if a hybrid combiner is high enough in quality, I will get 100 watts out of four modules of 25 watts each. And yet, when you make the measurement of any one port of that combiner to the sum port output, yes, you will see 6 dB of loss. And I know that's a conflict. And there's a lot more to the proper understanding of how a hybrid works. That's an art in itself. It turns out that when the two signals going into a hybrid are absolutely in phase with each other correctly, then they combine in a voltage manner for the hybrid, and what you think is 6 dB of loss disappears. I know that doesn't sound like it makes sense, but you've got to be careful now of making a one port at a time measurement as opposed to using all four ports at a time being fed by four in-phase amplifiers. Did that make a little bit of sense, Joe? The B2RYY, K2RY.
Repeater, timeout, Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
You got it, Joe.
Well, I tried to make simple measurements on this device by simply disconnecting the driver control voltage to each module, but letting it power be applied, let RF be applied, and checking the power of each module, but one at a time by itself. And the interesting thing is what I noticed, which I don't completely understand why. What you see with the same driver level that you originally got to give 100 watts out, if you disconnect all the modules except one, each module by themselves on a watt meter will only indicate 5 to 7 watts of power output.
That's almost exactly right, Joe, and I know that's a conflicting answer. If I have, just for simplicity, I'm going to give you one more piece of information on this one. That is, I'm using a 2-to-1 quadrature hybrid, or a 2-to-1 Wilkinson hybrid. One of them's got 90 degrees of phase shift, one's got 0 degrees of phase shift. But I'm using two signals going into a hybrid. And if I set the phase correctly of the two signals, all of the power out of those amplifiers appears at the common port out of that combiner. If each amplifier is running 25 watts, I will get 50 watts output. Turn off one of the amplifiers, and now only 25 watts is going in. You would expect 25 watts coming out. You get 12 and a half out. Let me show you that again. Two amplifiers, 25 watts each. I will get 50 watts out. Turn off one of the amplifiers. I get a 6 dB loss. They call it graceful degradation. But in reality, what's happening is that one amplifier experiences 6 dB of insertion loss. Two amplifiers experience 0 dB of insertion loss. You say to yourself, what the hell is going on here? In order for the two amplifiers to be isolated from each other, internally somewhere in the system, there is a load resistor. As long as the two amplifiers are in phase feeding the combiner, there is no voltage across that load resistor. No power gets dissipated. Every watt out of your amplifier, a pair of amplifiers, all comes out of the common port. Turn off one of the amplifiers as if it failed, and now half your power appears across the load resistor that gives you the isolation, and half of it goes to the output. You lose 6 dB. So when you measure one amplifier at a time, and you make a judgment that you're going to be getting that loss all the time when there are two amplifiers present, it's a very pessimistic answer. The real world's a lot better than that. I know that's not evil.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I know that's not logical the first time you hear it. I've got an article on the subject that'll help, Joe. If you go to K5RMG, Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG.org, you go to the Roadrunners Microwave Group, you tap on the indication of technical articles, you go to that page of technical articles, you go down to the bottom of the page where it's the K2RIW corner, and there's an article there on hybrids and directional couplers. It'll give you a lot more information that'll help. Some people have gone to that article and said, yeah, I never understood it. Now it makes a bit more sense. W2RYY for a final. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Thanks for the tip. I'll have to go in that direction, take a look at that stuff and see if that helps at all. I'm just trying to come up with an easy answer to a complicated problem. Back to you.
So lots of people for years have gone round and round with this one, Joe. You're in good company if you say, hey, it ain't simple, and it ain't easy to understand. Hybrid combining graceful degradation of multiple amplifiers with power dividing and power consuming devices, that's lots and lots of grief has occurred in that area because of misunderstandings. Mike is the next guy, KD2, Alpha Mike Zulu. What would you like to talk about tonight, Mike? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Well, thank you, Dick. One, I do have a generator, and it's probably hooked up, and I've been operating one for years and for work and personal. But my question is regarding the Wuxon KGUV920R-A radio. This is the new Wuxon mobile crossband radio, and I just got it. I wondered if anybody out there has any information on the cross-band operation of this radio. It seems to work fine, except it doesn't have the frequency shift for the repeater. It's has the CT tones or PL tones and all that stuff works, but the actual cross-band operation doesn't seem to work because, like I said, it doesn't have the offset frequency when it is in cross-band mode. Is there anyone who has information about this? Is there programming? Is there a firmware? Or is it just a fault in the radio? 82AMZ.
Mike, I'm going to play that back to you to make sure I understood what you just said. I did hear you a little bit earlier today discussing the situation. It's a cross-band radio. In other words, it has the ability to transmit on, let's say, 2 meters and 450. Those happen to be the two cross-bands. And so, in theory, it can transmit on one band, listen on the other, or it can transmit on a 2-meter repeater on 2 meters or a 450 repeater on 450. In the case of the 2-meter repeater, when you're going through it, you'd like to have the ability to have either a minus 600 kc offset or a plus 600 kc offset between transmit and receive. And when you're on 450 going through a repeater, you'd like to have 5 megacycles of plus or minus offset. So it's that offset that seems to be missing. When you study the owner's manual, it doesn't tell you how to get it, is what I think you're telling us. And I think you're asking, does anybody know about this Wuxon with this problem? Or is it just because you got an early serial number doesn't have this U.S. standard of 600 kc offset and 5 megacycle offset? Is that sort of the question, Mike? KD2AMZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
That's exactly the question, but in my particular case, again, it's low band 2-meter input, or whatever you want to call it, and the repeater function is going to be on the UHF, so it's a 5 megahertz offset. But yeah, it doesn't have that offset, and I've read online that some people have had it, some people haven't, and is it the way I'm programming it, or is it like I said, a firmware issue, which I kind of think what it is, or is it the manual that I'm reading? It's basically Chinese translated into English. Is there anybody out there with experience with this radio or has any idea? Because tomorrow I'm thinking of calling the distributor and having him explain.
WV2U with comment.
WV2U with comment. Start off with your name, sir. I should know you. And go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Name here is Paul. And don't have that rig, but I've got a Yaesu 747 satellite rig that I've programmed up to do cross-band repeat. And what I do is I actually program the cross-band function to output on the input of the repeater I'm trying to hit. So, you know, I've got a 440 receive, and it converts it to, the 2-meter input of the Limark repeater, and in my particular case, it works perfectly. So I don't use an offset or anything. I just manually program the exact frequency of the input.
Hey, you cut off very abruptly there, Paul. WV2U at Seaford, K2RIW. So rather than use the machine in a so-called quasi-automatic mode, in other words, many of the handy talkies and base station rigs that we have for either 2 meters, 450, for instance, have a so-called automatic mode where if you're on the 146 megacycle region, it knows to transmit 600 kc lower, and if you're on the 147 meg region, it knows to transmit 600 kc higher, for instance. So I'm going to call that the quasi-automatic mode of offset, and maybe Wuxon doesn't have that. And so when you looked on the internet, you found some people who had this problem, some people didn't have the problem, and you foxed the rules on your particular rig by programming the transmit frequency and the receive frequency such that you programmed in the requirement for that channel to be 600 kc offset, for instance, on 2 meters. I think that's what you're saying, Joe. You're going to give me Paul, you're going to give me a confirmation on that. And second of all, where some of the guys on the internet didn't have the problem and some did, was it because they were all buying the rig from the same source? I mean, depending on how you get the rig, is it properly programmed for the American standard of those offsets. WV2U, K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul. Okay. I'm not hearing Paul right now, and he did stop abruptly before, so we're not quite sure what happened. When it comes to the Wuxon that Mike is asking us about, does anyone else on frequency know a way of getting around the Wuxon problem, let me call it the automatic offset? Or is Mike going to be forced into doing individual programming of transmit and receive frequencies in order to work around this problem? Anybody's got that information? Please give us your call letters right now. K2LAW in the TechNet. Something like DVM with information. Go right ahead. The person that came before DVM, you were 95% noise, 5% audio, and were not copyable. DVM question mark. Give us the call letter slowly, phonetically, and your name, and then proceed with your information. K2RIW.
This is KD2BVM, Bravo Victor Mike. The name is Kim, and I have a similar radio, the Wuxon KG. UVD1P, and I had to buy the software separately for it to program the radio, and it gives you a place to put the offset in. And we had to program it through a PC and just plug it into the radio, and then all of that information comes up.
Very fine. Bravo, Victor Mike. Kim, very good information. Kim, where did you go to buy that software? How much did the software cost, and how long did it take you to get it? How did you find out about this beautiful software that with an external computer you can straighten this all out? How did you find that out, and what it cost you, Kim? Kilo Delta 2, Bravo, Victor Mike, K2LIW.
I purchased the software at the same time as I got the radio at a ham fest, Briarcliff College, a while back. And the gentleman that sold me the radio highly recommended that I got the disc to go with it. And I had one of my friends who is an amateur extra sit down with me one night, and we went through the computer directory, and we did it, frequency by frequency, and it worked out just fine. It took us maybe 15, 20 minutes once we had the program loaded into the PC.
Hey, to AMZ.
AMZ, we'll get back to you in a second. Now, Kim, what did that software cost you? Back to you, Kim.
I think it was $16.95.
Fantastic. Go ahead, Mike. KD2AMZ, you got a mic.
The person, I didn't catch her name. That applies to the KG6 series. The KG6 series, the software is free online by using a UV commander, the free software. The interface is a USB to, in essence, a Kenwood interface, which is a prolific interface. If you get prolific drivers, it works fine. That is really not the case with this particular radio. That does apply to the KG6 series, which I also happen to own and know all about that programming. This radio, again, doesn't have that feature where you can give it, a transmit frequency and a receive frequency discreetly. You have to give it a frequency, which is the receive, and then you plug in an offset into the system. And this only works on the crossband repeat. Under normal operations, it works perfectly. So it's a good solution, but doesn't apply. That applies to the 6 series. And the software for the Wuxon 6 series is free, and it's available on UV Commander. And all you need is a Kenwood type of prolific driver and USB to Kenwood adapter, which is about $3 on the internet to take care of that problem. Now, this is something that's a little bit different. And I guess, and again, what I've read, other people have it, and I really think what the situation is, I think it's a firmware error. That's what I think it is. Unless there's some other kind of programming. Has anyone actually for the 920 have actual software for it? Because I don't think it's available yet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
DC2IS.
It sounded like KC2IS, Kilo Charlie 2 India Sierra is what it sounded like. Please correct me. Please give us your name, sir, and then proceed with your information. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
This is Alpha Charlie 2 India Sierra Phil, AC2IS. Don't have a lot of information here on the 920. I was wondering what it costs. I've heard prices around $300 for that radio. I have written a document on programming the UED1P and could possibly share that.
Okay, let's see if that's what Mike is looking for. KD2AMZ, does that sound like what you're looking for, what Bill is offering, Mike? K2RAW, you got a mic?
Yeah, I didn't catch the model number and the manufacturer of the paper that you wrote. Could you repeat that, please?
Okay, Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra. Go right ahead, Bill. So I think you're saying you wrote a paper on this, Bill, as to how to do the programming, and how would that be available to Mike? AC2IS, K2RIW.
I don't think my document is going to help him. That was just sort of a point of curiosity, I guess. I did write a document on programming the HT, the UVD1P, which is what I'm talking to you guys with right now. So found links to a number of other resources on programming that particular radio. It's an HT. But the 920 is a pretty new radio, and I do not have information on that. I was also wondering what it cost. There was a lot of speculation on the price of that unit, and I don't know what it's been selling for.
If I understand correctly, Bill doesn't have what's going to help you, Mike, but Bill does want to know what you paid for that radio. I guess he knew that an inexpensive Chinese-made radio was coming down the pike, and I think it's the 920 series that you've got, Mike, and because of its low price, it's very attractive once this problem is solved. So what did that cost you, Mike? KD2AMZ, K2LAW?
I have seen the price from $275 to about $325. So anywhere's in that price range, $375 to about $325.
Okay, so I think it's the 920 series that Mike has, works on dual band radio, and how to properly program the offset, the 600 KC offset for 2 meters and the 5 megacycle offset for 450. Anybody with any further information on that, please give us your call letters right now, K2RIW on the TechNet.
And it only applies to the crossband operation. Under normal operation, works perfectly.
Okay, we didn't get an answer from somebody else, but now I'm going to need clarification. If it works perfectly when you're in one band at a time, but it doesn't work correctly when you're in the crossband mode, I'm a bit confused by this. In the crossband mode, I presume you might transmit on a frequency on 2 meters, and you listen to a frequency on 450, or vice versa. And whether that's going through a satellite that's doing that, or a coupled repeater that's doing it, a dual band repeater, cross band repeater. In that particular case, if for instance I was going from transmit on 2 to listen on 450, and as long as I program in the correct frequency for transmission on 2, and the correct receiver frequency on 450, I'm having a little trouble finding out why it must automatically create the 600 KC offset. Why can't you do that manually, if you know what I mean? In other words, you're going to transmit with the 600 KC offset because you programmed it that way, but you don't listen to the 2-meter output when you're transmitting on 2 meters. You're listening to the 450 output. So now I'm a little bit confused as to what the problem is, Mike. KD2AMZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Now, let me clarify a little bit, Dick. I know it's confusing. The way I need it to operate is the remote, whatever you want to call it, is on 2-meter simplex. The crossband goes to the 400, I forget, 443 or whatever, megahertz. That's going into a repeater. The repeater has a offset, and it also has a PL. The radio is doing a proper PL, but it's not doing an offset. It's transmitting as if it was simplex in, simplex out. Now, it's supposed to be whatever in, simplex in this case, and it, and on the output, it's supposed to be whatever you want it to be. You program it to be with an offset or no offset, you can do that. It doesn't do that, unfortunately. And that is what the issue with other people have been having. So that is, you know, again, it's a rather confusing subtlety, but it's that offset that it doesn't want to do, you know, in only in the crossband mode. When you turn the crossband off, that it works perfectly. I think it's a flaw in the firmware of the system, and I hope to clarify with the distributor in California that I got it. Hopefully I'll have a clarification. My hope was somebody out there has a Wuxon 920 who has a similar problem or in a solution.
I make sure there's enough delay in case somebody has information here. Let me try to ask the question one more time, Mike, so I can understand it. When you're in the crossband mode, there is one frequency you are going to transmit on 2 meters, for instance. There's one particular frequency you're going to listen on 450, for instance, and you continue to operate that way. I'm beginning to think, even though you haven't said it, you want to be able to flip back and forth between crossband and non-crossband mode, but still operate on the same two bands. That 2-meter repeater, when you flip over to the non-crossband mode, you want that frequency you've dialed in as the receive frequency to automatically create the 600 KC offset when you transmit on 2 meters. Or conversely, when you flip to the non-crossband mode on 450, you want it to automatically take that frequency you were on for listening, and when you transmit on the 450 repeater, it does the 5 meg offset. So I think you're trying to program the receive frequency on 450, the receive frequency on 2 meters, but you're in the crossband mode, and you want it to be smart enough so that if you crossband low in, high out, and then you flip crossband high in, low out, you want it to always be doing the offsets automatically. I think that's what's going on here. KD2AMZ, K2LAW. Go ahead, Mike.
Question, Dick.
There was a person there who just responded there, Dick. Why don't you let him pick it up?
Yeah, go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Dick, just a quick question. Mike, have you tried listening to both of those frequencies on a separate receiver to confirm that it's going to where you're sending it? And it couldn't be a receive PL issue, could it?
Yes, John, I have tried that. I have done that. And again, it's a simple problem of each channel is programmed individually into this radio with its own PL, with its own offset for a particular repeater in this case. When it's individual, works fine. It's only when it's in crossband mode that it forgets to put in the offset, but it does put in the PL tone. So that's why I think it's an error in the firmware of the radio.
Okay, Mike, when you're on your crossband mode and you press the transmit button, do you see the frequency shift on the digits as you would in simplex mode? Is that working?
No, that's the point. It is, the digits are not changing. You can see that, you know, normally you can change it, you know, have the offset every time you put the transmit or whatever, it's not changing. That's the whole problem. And that's the problem that other people have been experiencing that I've been looking at on the net. So that's what I think the bug is. I probably got an earlier firmware version. I bet you the newer firmware version has that problem solved.
Yeah, sounds like you're right, Mike. It does sound like it's a firmware problem, which is something you might be able to upload right on the net. Okay, Dick, back to you, KC2WGB.
Was there another person who said...
Oh, my God.
Was there another person who said they had information on this particular Wuxon 920 series? And by the way, my question to you also, Mike, when it comes back to you, is going to be the digits on the dial when you're transmitting. Is it telling the truth? And I think the answer is yes. So at least you know by the frequency you see on the dial, you know where you're transmitting. Therefore, you know it's not doing the offset. Had you programmed, assuming now that the radio has enough channels, where you've got a whole bunch of channels, you program channels 1 through 15, you program for simplex operation on 2 meters and on 450. Channel 16 through 30, you program this other way, where when you're in the crossband mode, you know what frequency you want to transmit on, so you program that for the so-called frequency for 2 meters and 450. So I wonder if you can get around it that way. So, first of all, does the dial always tell the truth as to where it's transmitting? In which case, as long as you've got enough channels, I think there may be a way around this by foxing it, if you know what I mean, Mike. KDQAMZ, drag your feet a little bit. KQRIW in the TechNet.
CH with a comment.
Oh, man, what the silly...
KC2IS.
Okay, I heard Bill, but before I heard Bill, it sounded like... something ACT with a comment. The person who said with a comment, who was that?
Yes, Ray and I just was going to say, maybe you could try a Yahoo group. Maybe there's one for that radio.
Thank you, sir. I haven't found it because I think this radio is just too new. I think that's what the problem is. So, I think, I've dominated the conversation here long enough. There are other people here. I think the answer is I'm going to make a phone call tomorrow to California distributors, see what they know about it, and I'll give them the serial number. I'm going to find out if this is one of the first lots manufactured. Johnson, I think it's a firmware issue. That's all it is. And this is an issue that I think is going to be around until this radio has seen a little bit more exposure out there. KD2AMZ.
Mike, where I made a suggestion where channels 0 through 15, you program them in the simplex mode for 2 meters and 450, and channels 16 through 30, you know you're going to be using those on crossband. Therefore, you program in the frequency you want to transmit and the frequency you want to receive in the crossband mode. Why would that not work, Mike? Go ahead.
The reason being is this radio is not capable of doing that manually. When I receive my programming cable, kind of like a UV commander or something, and maybe I can actually put in a manual frequency, ignoring all the offsets and whatnot, I'll just punch it right in. And it'll give it directly, if you know what I'm trying to say, like in a spreadsheet, like I do with my KG series. I just give it directly. I don't bother with the offsets.
Okay. I'm having a problem here, Mike. A crossband repeater, in many cases... there is no relationship between the 2-meter frequency and the 450 frequency. The 2-meter input could be anywhere from 146 to 148, and the 450 output could be anywhere from 440 to 450. There's no relationship between the two. When you're running crossband through a particular satellite, yes, there's a direct relationship between the two. So what you're calling crossband, is it the satellite mode, or... when you're running crossband through a repeater, where the two are independent of each other, I'm having trouble understanding why channels 15 through 30 can't be programmed to the frequencies you want. Over to you, Mike, KQRIW.
That is precisely the case there, Dick. That is precisely what this radio is not allowing me to do. And I don't know yet, but maybe once I get my programming cable, I hope to get it a couple of days, then I will be able to do it. But by doing it through the manual and twisting and turning the dials and pressing the buttons X number of times, it won't allow me that flexibility. I'm hoping that once I get the programming cable, I can hook it up to my laptop and download the software and then make it work. I'm hoping that will be the case. But in the meantime, I am going to call the distributor and see what their solution is.
Okay, I think it was Bill, ACQIS. Bill, you said you had some further information, K2LIW.
Confirming the problem with the 920R that it has this problem. I've got another comment here on the same site. A person saying that menu 32, that entry being called X-TWRPP, needs to be used or needs to be set in order for this to work correctly. I don't know if that's just something that he needs to do to turn on crossbanding or if this is what he needs to fix his problem. I would not be surprised if maybe the radio had the capability he's looking for, but the documentation was horrible. The documentation on the UBD-1P was especially bad.
Station break in KD2AMZ. Yes, the manual is hard, and yes, I did use menu 32. Again, maybe the manufacturer will give me some leadway tomorrow, and I think we're just spinning our wheels here, gentlemen. Until I reach out to them and experiment more, this is just such a new device, I don't think anybody really has an answer quite just yet.
Okay, yeah, Mike. As you do that further research, Mike, please come back and tell us what you find. I got a suspicion that it's just a Chinese to English translation that didn't go into this particular area, didn't give you the right information yet. Let's hopefully you do get it. And when you talk to the distributor tomorrow, maybe he's got some answers for you. Let's go over to JD next. Kilo two, Alpha Delta Victor. Go right ahead, JD, KQLIW.
Dick, after that, a question on Joe's previous question, when you get a chance.
I can wait a second, John.
Go right ahead, John, with your further information.
JD, thank you. Dick, I was just thinking about Joe's issue. Is it possible for him to combine one